Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. Welcome to tonight's event. We're pleased to present this with Books on the Bus, an evening with Bruce Barcott. Thanks to Elliott Bay Book Company for co-presenting this evening. We thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis. And finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Okay, so I'm going to turn things over to Carla Salter, who I think is probably best known for her as the author of the blog, The Bus Chick.
Hi, everybody. Thanks to all of you for coming. I'm actually not here in that capacity. I'm here as an employee of Transportation Choices Coalition. And I just want to give you a little bit of context about Books on the Bus before we get started, because I know probably a lot of you came here through the library rather than through Books on the Bus. But Transportation Choices is a statewide policy and advocacy nonprofit dedicated to bringing Washingtonians more and better transportation choices. We work hard to preserve and expand public transit across the state. And as many of you know, that's a pretty tough job right now because a lot of agencies, including King County Metro, are facing devastating cuts. If you're interested in getting involved, you can talk to me or our field director, Kate, after the program. But in addition to our work to preserve and expand service, Transportation Choices also offers education and outreach programs to encourage ridership. One such program is Books on the Bus, which is a quarterly book club for bus and train riders, and it's designed to take advantage of public transportation's inherent strengths, time to read and immersion in a unique, temporary, and very diverse community. Every quarter, we select a book for participants to read on their bus rides, and at the end of the three-month reading period, we host an event to celebrate and discuss the book. Then we repeat the process with a different book. And all of our selections have a local focus, so they're either written by a local writer or they take place in the Pacific Northwest, or in this case, both. And we hope that Books on the Bus will encourage conversation and interaction on buses and at stops. We also hope that the books we choose for the program will contribute to the broader community discussion about the issues that are important to all of us. So our current selection is The Measure of a Mountain by Bruce Barcott. And this book had a cheerleader on our staff, our field director, Kate Whiting, who grew up exploring the Olympics and who continues to spend as much time as she can hiking and climbing in our beautiful state, recommended it highly. And I'm really glad she did. The Measure of a Mountain is much more than a book about climbing or one man's personal achievement. It is a book that attempts to understand Rainier, the incomparable natural wonder that looms both literally and figuratively over our lives. So Terry Tazzioli is here to lead the discussion about the book, and we're delighted to have him. Terry is the host of Well Read, an author interview program originating with TVW in Olympia and KBTC-TV in Tacoma, broadcast nationally by PBS. He is a Seattle native and longtime journalist, including assignment editor and producer at King TV and lifestyles editor, then travel editor for the Seattle Times. Terry, thank you very much for being here.
Believe it or not, this is Bruce Barcott. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
We're going to have a conversation. We're just going to talk for a while. This is my ratty notebook, which I take everywhere. And, you know, it's just like, yes, I use a computer, but I love scribbling notes. And I did when I was reading his book. And I also, I have to do some research because they want me to introduce him. Uh-oh. So I had to find out about this guy. He was born in Everett, Washington, a Washington State native. I love asking this question. How many of you were born and raised in the state of Washington? Ooh, this is not a big, that's good. You were, this is not your first book. measure of a mountain, right?
No.
There are three of them.
Three of them. The first one was actually an anthology, so I didn't do most of the bulk of the writing.
Okay.
It was just a lot of editing.
But still.
But yeah, this was sort of the second book. It was written in my... This was a book that sort of started in my mid-20s, almost 20 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
I had just done this anthology called Northwest Passages, and that was a book of basically writing about the Pacific Northwest from, basically Native American tales to Sherman Alexie. And it was a way to try to sort of get a handle on writing from this region. And back then, this was the early 90s, you really could, read the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I literally went over to UW, spent nights there, just going through anything I could find about the Northwest. And after doing that, I was sort of looking for a way to connect myself both personally and in my writing to some part of the Pacific Northwest. One of the great traditions of Northwest writing is about engaging with the landscape, whether it's Annie Dillard in The Living or all the great books about the Columbia River. There's a huge amount of interaction with rivers and with trees and with mountains in that body of work. And around that same time, there were, I think, three or four books that had just come out about the Columbia River. I think Robin Cody wrote one, maybe Bill Dietrich wrote one.
He did,
I think.
Bill Dietrich
yeah,
wrote one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and a couple others had come out. And I was thinking, well, that's great. What about the mountains? What about Rainier? There's really nothing been written on that since, I think, Dee Molnar wrote a couple books on Rainier, but there hadn't been anything that really tried to wrap your hands around the mountains. So that's kind of where the book started.
Which is called Measure of a Mountain, mm-hmm. and it won the Governor's Award, Washington State Governor's Award, after it was published in 1997.
Yeah.
So writing this book, it can't have been that simple that you looked around and thought, here's something to write about.
No, I mean, you can say that, but it's like, how do you do it then?
There was you had an attraction to this,
yeah,
this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it?
Yeah. I think it was, like I said, that personal drive or yearning to connect with some part of the landscape. I had grown up, my family's all from Everett. I had grown up mostly around Puget Sound when I was a kid, a few years in Alaska and a few years in California, and went to the UW and had kind of had this push-pull relationship with the Northwest. Went to the UW, but then couldn't wait to get back to New York after I graduated. Spent a year back there.
Mm-hmm.
And after spending a year back there, couldn't wait to get back to Seattle. I was sort of wrestling with my own thoughts, feelings, emotions about this actual place and whether I really wanted to stay here or not. And, going up into the mountains and hiking and getting out into nature was one of the parts of my childhood that was sort of nearest and dearest to me. Mm-hmm. And that was actually not so much here as up in Alaska when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And so I guess, part of this was to try to see if I could find that part of, what I loved about my childhood here in the Northwest, and Rainier was the best place to do it.
Mm-hmm. I just kind of laughed that you attempted to do your first, I think I can call it a trek around the mountain.
Yeah.
And you were on the Wonderland Trail. You didn't last very long.
No, it was terrible. I mean, that was, first of all, my first mistake was setting out the day after Labor Day, which I thought would mean there would be no crowds. Everybody's, gone for the summer. Well, there's a reason everybody's gone for the summer. And it's because the weather turns nasty like the day after Labor Day. As I was working on this book, it wasn't just that year. Like, I would go back pretty much every year on Labor Day weekend or the day after Labor Day that week, and it was just rainy and windy and horrible the whole time through. I lasted a leg and then came back to do other legs.
Right. What, a year? Not that he did this every day for a year, but was it a year later?
It was
later
about a year. I was rain-soaked. I was just completely hammered. It was my first time out alone, and I really wasn't sure that I could do it then. I wasn't sure I could make it through. And looking back now, it's really not that difficult. I mean, I've done a lot of other things that are more difficult since then. But, you know, those first couple nights sitting there in a tent alone, you're like, you know, I don't know if I can do this, you know. And that was one of the great fears, was just essentially failing. But at the same time, one of the things that you know, I learned through this book is a lot of what happens on mountains is failure. And for me, there's a lot of failure in this book, but that often makes for great writing.
There is, and there's a, you have an interesting way of looking at that we might talk about later, or you all get a chance to be me for a while, pretty soon, so I'll let you know. And we all call it something, the mountain or Rainier, and some people call it my mountain. And I thought about, some ways it seems a little pretentious, and I'm not sure where all that comes from. What do you call it now? Well, what do you think about this thing?
I call it Rainier. Fortunately, you know, we don't have a Mount McKinley Denali fight going on here, but we did, you know, many years ago, whether to call it Rainier or Tacoma. I don't call it my mountain. I do feel like I have a relationship with it, but I know so many people who have so much greater and deeper relationships with it, a number of whom are still good friends. I don't go much further than that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the book gets you a certain amount of play in terms of assumptions about people's assumptions about your relationship with the mountain.
It does.
You know, in the course of writing the book, like I say, I've met so many other people who are there daily and who are hiking daily, whether it's, you know, my friend Mike Gauthier Gator, who's in the book, mm-hmm. the climbing ranger, and Bronca Sundstrom.
No kidding.
Who were in the book.
I went back and read, if you haven't read the book, mm-hmm. or even if you have, that's a place where I went back and read, because I could not believe how many times this couple had gone up to camp.
Oh, yeah. Here,
and they're just a little bit older
yeah.
than I am.
Yeah, yeah. In their 80s.
Yeah.
Ake passed away about 4 years ago.
Really?
Yeah. Bronca's still there, still goes hiking up to Camp Muir. You know, it was amazing. I went down for the memorial service for Ake a few years ago, and you know, just the outpouring of folks who knew him and, you know, appreciated his presence on the mountain and the goodwill that he had, you know, going up and down all the time was amazing.
She said, maybe they both did something that I think is pretty interesting, and you talk about it in a different way in the book, too. She said that, I think she was asked, why do you come up here so many times? They're talking about 40 climbs in mm-hmm. one season.
Season, yeah.
And I, you know, besides sitting there with my mouth open, there was a great question, well, what's new? I mean, doesn't this get boring? And she said, no, that every single time there's something new. And that's when I began to think about something you said early on in the book, that most of us don't know Mount Rainier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would like to know what you mean by that. And when she said that to you, that something's new every time,
yeah,
does she know this place?
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, she said, I think she used a phrase, it was either, you know, I see it through fresh eyes every
yes.
time. You know, that's a phrase that still stays with me. I still use that phrase when I come upon new experiences in old places. You know, see something with fresh eyes, with new eyes. I just love that phrase. In terms of, you know, Rainier being a mountain that few of us really know, you know, we see it from afar here in Seattle when the clouds part and there it is, you know, that amazing vista looking at the mountain, and it's so gorgeous. And it's a symbol of, for many of us, the reason that we stay here or live here and love it. It's that connection to nature that's so available to us. But at the same time, like I said, it's a mountain that few of us really know, because it's a pile of rocks down there that's incredibly dynamic. It can be very dangerous. You know, there are days when I would go up to Camp Muir to do a little research up there, and up at Camp Muir it would just be howling, and you know, I would have to go down because my feet were starting to freeze. And you'd come back down to Paradise, and the Paradise parking lot, you know, it's July or it's August, and there are people running around all over the place, you know, coming up in flip-flops and in shorts and tank tops, and you're coming down and with a 3-day growth of beard, and you're, oh my God, gotta warm my toes. And so there are these weird ways in which different mountains, in a way, exist simultaneously. Like there's the Paradise Valley with the amazing wildflowers, and it's so welcoming to everybody. But then you go up 5,000 feet to Camp Muir, and man, you got to have your stuff together, or it's going to turn bad for you really quickly. You know, they still lose people now and then on the Camp Muir route, which, you know, Aki and Bronco would hike 40 times a year. And if you go up on a sunny Saturday with a lot of people there, it's a pretty straightforward trail. Mm-hmm. But then you go up on Monday and the clouds descend, all of a sudden you're in a whiteout, and, you know, people take a wrong turn all the time into the glacier and don't make it out. You know, so it's
the end of the book, the end of Measure of a Mountain is all about your climb.
Mm-hmm.
And leading up to that, in a good way, if I might, you're all over the ballpark. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a study on getting ready to do this. And you weren't even sure you wanted to do it, even when you got to the top.
Yeah.
There's the place where you can sign, and there's you.
Yeah, yeah. I knew, you know, I had to do it or at least give it a try, both for myself and for the book. And the book wasn't going to be complete without giving it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I were a reader, I would be like, hey, come on, you got to try for the top, right? There was also a part of me that sort of resisted that, A, because it was also a bit of a cliche, B, because I didn't have the drive to climb to the summit that so many others did. By that time, I had met a number of climbers, you know, professional guides and people who did Everest and other Himalayan peaks, and they have within them an almost superhuman drive to do this. It's who they are. It's what they do. And this is not what I do. You know, I loved being in that area from, you know, the low forest to Camp Muir. And then above Camp Muir, Camp Muir is about 10,000 feet. The summit's 14,000 mm-hmm. feet. That's a really, really tough area.
And that last 4,000 feet.
Yeah, the last 4,000 feet. You know, when I did it with my father, he wanted to do it because it was sort of his shot. You know, he was in his 50s, and he said, like, you know, might as well try now. I'm not going to be able to try in 10 years. You know, when I got back from that climb, or when I got to the summit, like I say, you know, we got to the summit, and you could go and sign the register over there, you know, or not. And I decided not to, and I was just like, what's the point of that? Like, we made it. And by the time you're up there, a lot of that climb, for me, was essentially just drawing upon the will to keep going. Because so much of your body and mind says, why are you doing this? Turn around, go down. This is not a very smart thing to do, and it's physically very, very difficult.
Well, you talked about that even leading up to your own climb, mm-hmm. that as you talked to other climbers, especially people who had done the Whitaker brothers and Willie Unsold and others who've done much higher, my sense from you was that you thought they were a little nuts.
Yeah, I did. One of the things that I did, you know, in the book was I went through and read as much climbing literature as I could, and there's a lot of it out there. It's a great, you know, body of work on climbing, and I actually went down and used the Mountaineers have their own library, and it's a really cool library to get into. For an outsider, the cavalier dealing with death can be a little bit strange or off-putting. So for me, it was just like, well, why are you doing this? What's really the point of all of this? Even I think after the book came out, I started writing for Outside Magazine, and I started encountering and writing about more and more mountain climbers, you know, world-class mountain climbers. Like I said, that's when I think that I came to see that for them, climbing these mountains was as much a drive as writing is for me. Like, it's just something that I need to do. It's how I express myself, but it's also sort of a function of how I operate in the world. And for them, I think that's a similar kind of thing. That's what they have to get out there. And not just climb or reach the summit, but climb and test themselves physically and mentally and experience that the pain and the exhilaration and the accomplishment and the fellowship of the climbers they're with. Like, that's a huge part of it.
Here's something that I kind of still don't understand. I've read, I think this is the 50th anniversary this year of Jim Whitaker's mm-hmm. climb, the first mm-hmm. American,
right.
first
right.
American anyway, to summit Mount Everest. In those days, if you will, I think I was alive,
mm-hmm.
it seemed like this enormous accomplishment, this grand adventure.
Right, it's like a moonshot. Yeah.
Because exactly.
Yeah.
And I've seen photos, maybe all of you have too, in National Geographic, for example, The trek up Everest looks like a freeway.
Oh yeah,
it's that Chilkoot
Pass photo,
yeah.
Right? Yeah,
yes.
like all these people just lining up.
And how many people summit Rainier a year? Is it? I want to say five.
I think about 6,000.
6,000,
5,000 try, 6,000 make it. Yeah.
So at this point, when I look at this, I just don't get it anymore. What's the thrill?
You know, for me, climbing Rainier was so much about climbing this mountain that was home, that was part of home. Mm-hmm. You know, and then I climbed a little on Mount St. Helens and Baker as well. But there was never any push in my gut to, I want to climb Denali next, or do this next, or do this next. I think for a lot of people, Everest now has become, you know, something that's part of their personal success pyramid. And I don't think that they're necessarily that connected to mountains themselves, mm-hmm. or the region. It's just the idea of being able to say, yes, I climbed Mount Everest. And part of what feeds into that is our just general nature as humans to use mountains and climbing mountains as such a basic, powerful metaphor, mm-hmm. right? Used in business every day. We're climbing to the top of this mountain. We're going to get to the summit. We're going to, you know, nail our sales goals or whatever it is. But it's that, you know, metaphor made actually real on Mount Everest. And you combine that with the fact that it's so much more accessible to people because of the existence of guide services and everything. One of my best friends actually runs a major guide service on Everest, and he does it really well. But he, you know, he encounters challenges every year with folks who are heading up who are less experienced than they should be or that they claim to be.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask something else there, but I would rather ask you first. You call Rainier the most dangerous mountain or the most dangerous volcano in the United States. Why is it so dangerous? What's the danger?
There was actually really recently, like last week, there was a piece on Slate, Blade of the Atlantic, and the writer had set out to do a story on, I'm going to mangle the name, but it's the volcano near Mexico City, Popo. There we go.
Thank you very much.
Right? And he set out, and the premise of his piece, of his reporting, was that this was the most dangerous mountain or volcano in essentially North America, North American region. The more he did the reporting, the more volcano experts said, well, you know, it is very active, and it's really interesting for that reason. But in terms of actual risk and danger, there are others that are dangerous. And by the end of the article, toward the end, he said, well, you know, what is, and they said, well, you know, actually it's the one you want to look at is Mount Rainier. And it's not because it's as active as the Mexican volcanoes or even Alaskan or Hawaiian volcanoes, but it's the proximity to population. Also the idea that the danger with Rainier comes in the form of a unexpected and essentially unpredictable landslide, mm-hmm. and a massive landslide, a little hard, because it's essentially sitting up there sort of cooking its rocks day after day after day with sort of warm acidic mm-hmm. water running through the mountain. And so they're not really sure what sort of indicators the mountain puts out to say, okay, yeah, I'm kind of building up now and I'm going to shed some rock. And it's mm-hmm. not a sort of huge volcanic explosion. It's more like, you know, just a chunk of it falling down. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that Rainier is so lumpy on top is they believe that it used to be more like a Mount Fuji, a beautiful, perfect cone. Mm-hmm. And thousands of years ago, that, you know, top of that beautiful cone just roared down through the Ording Valley. And
that's right. I think, I'm going to pretend I'm a mountain, Mount Rainier, with sort of, you know, like this. And you put your fingers on top of the peak now and formed a point.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's what geologists think that it looked like.
Yeah, roared, I mean, basically went all the way to Commencement Bay.
Into the bay.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, so Mount Rainier is falling apart.
It is. You can see it falling apart most easily, you know, at the edges of the glaciers. If you go up there and get near enough, you can see it just spitting rocks, you know, out of the ends of glaciers. But, you know, there are, on the summit, there are steam caves that are sort of snow and ice free during parts of the year because, you know, it's cooking this warm vented air and steam, breaking itself down.
Your dad was, if not the impetus, one of them for your climb of Rainier, because he wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And you both went. He got pretty far. What does he think of the book?
Oh, I think he likes it quite a bit. Yeah. He was really disappointed. They turned him around at about 12,500 feet. And the reason was the altitude got to his body and he couldn't, he could no longer really eat or drink. You got to eat, drink, and breathe to make it up, because you're burning so many calories. You really have to keep eating or you're going to break down. And so the guides at certain rest points will check in with everybody, and he was done, and he kind of knew it.
And so after the book, has either of you been back?
I've been back to Rainier quite a bit. Not so much in the last few years. I'm working on other projects that
climbing the mountain to the top.
Oh no, not climbing. No. I actually used to. I would go back after the book came out. I would go back and hang out with friends at Camp Muir and Camp Sherman, the two high climbing camps. Mm-hmm. I had friends who were climbing rangers up there, and so I'd go up and spend some time with them. Mm-hmm. But even then, it was no. I was perfectly happy hanging out there and enjoying the mountain at that level. You know.
Well, that was interesting too, because I remember reading, mostly because I was looking for things that would suit me in this book, and your dad is a much better climber than I am. It's the notion of if you will, we all in this room consider, you'd say, where's Rainier? And we'd all point in the same direction because we know it's there.
Right.
It's always there.
Right.
And there's a difference in sitting at some point away from the mountain and looking at it and knowing it that way, and then standing on it. It's obviously an entirely different thing.
Yeah.
Which do you prefer?
You know, actually, I prefer standing on it or near it.
Why?
I really prefer. There are all sorts of things that happen to me or others. You know, I'm not the only one that feels this way. My father-in-law up there can tell you all about it. But there's a sort of a mental refreshment or cleansing that goes on when you're out there. You know, the air you're breathing is different. The things you're looking at are different. Your mind is allowed to just go, not go blank, but clear away a lot of the clutter that gets in the way during our daily lives down here. Part of that is that you're focused on keeping yourself safe. You're watching the weather. You know, you've got your life is sort of down to more basic things. Like, where's the trail? What's the weather like? Have I got food and water and all the gear I need? What's the time of day and what's the light like? But I always, whenever I'm up there in the mountains, I'm always coming up with, really good story ideas or thoughts about my life and what I want to do next or what I don't want to do, what I want to change for the better, this sort of thing. That, for me, it's tough to do in another kind of landscape. You know, I've been a lot of landscapes since then, jungle down in Central America and over on the South Pacific a couple of years ago. And those sorts of landscapes just don't have that same sort of action for me.
Mm-hmm. I have one more question for you. Then I actually have 1,000 more questions for you. But this is, what was harder, writing the book or climbing Mount Rainier?
Writing the book, because climbing Mount Rainier, you knew what the objective was. You knew how to get there. I had guides, professional guides, who knew what they were doing. I was in good hands. Writing the book, I wrote this book mostly in a small little apartment over on Lower Queen Anne Hill, and I'd have these all sorts of post-its and chapters laid out and trying to figure out how the hell it all fit together, what the sort of organizing principle of the book could be, might be, should be. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of chapters I think I ended up just throwing out. There's no guidebook, there's no guiding force. I mean, now to me, looking back, sort of arc of the book seems fairly obvious. You know, I start approaching the mountain at its lowest levels and then hike around it and then go to the high climbing camps and then finally to the summit, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're in the throes of it, it can be really hard to see that. And also, there are chapters in here about insects in winter and other parts of the mountain that just sort of, they come about in happenstance ways. Mm-hmm. And you're spending a lot of time on that, and you don't ever know whether it's going to pay off, you know, whether you're just going to have to toss all those weeks of work, you know. So that was definitely more difficult,
Well, I'm now using it as my excuse for not climbing Mount Rainier and others that there are bugs up there, too. there are insects that survive it.
Yeah.
I don't like bugs, so hey, I'll just stay here. Okay, it's your turn. Here's Bruce. What would you like to ask him? Please feel free.
How did I resist the temptation to write this as a mountaineering book? And I think part of it was I wanted to write a fuller biography of this mountain, and I wanted to approach it from a number of different aspects. The other part of it was I knew very well, too well, my own limitations, and was not a climber, had not been a climber, and met climbers fairly early on in researching the book. The one thing I, you know, learned about them very early is you can't bullshit them. They know what you've done and you know what your skill level is, and you can't fake it. And you don't want to fake it because it's very dangerous to fake it. So that was a big part of it, was that my own limitations, I knew I couldn't go in that direction, and I thought that maybe they would actually work as an advantage in allowing me to sort of ask the big dumb questions that a lot of people who aren't climbers want to know about mountains and what goes on there and why people, you know, climb them. She was asking about the number of people who attempt to climb Rainier in the years since I wrote the book. And it's funny, it really hasn't exploded like Everest at all. It's still very popular. I think that there's been a little bit of a shift more toward using climbing services, some fewer climbers going up on their own independently, but that's partly because there are at least three different climbing services now that operate on the mountain. You know, it saw a big sort of bit of a spike after John Krakauer and Into Thin Air. I think a lot of mountains did, but really since then it's not sort of overrun to the extent that it's become a problem. The question was, if I had a choice of going one place for a day on Rainier, where would I go? You know, I really love, in the summertime, Indian Henry's hunting ground, that area around there. You know, there's some neat little pocket lakes, alpine lakes up there. Just, there aren't a lot of people up there. When the flowers are out and it's sunny, you can't beat it. And I really also, I love that east side area, Indian Bar. I really like that area. Those are my favorite. I tell you, if I did it again, I think the best preparation, in a way, is hiking a big chunk of the Wonderland Trail around Rainier. You know, you get out there. I would get out there, and basically, like the third day, you get these legs, you get your hiking legs, and you just feel, you know, like you can go and go and go. You know, another thing to think about too is the dealing with the altitude. It's tough because, you know, we're here, it's sitting here at sea level, and the tough going really starts at 10,000 feet up there, and so the air and the altitude really can throw you for a loop and get nauseous or all sorts of nasty conditions. We lived for a year or two up in Boulder, Colorado, and it always struck me that, man, if I was doing Rainier, going to Boulder for a week or two and hiking in the mountains up there around Chautauqua, you know, up into the Rockies would be great. You know, you're already a mile high, and getting up there in the thinner air would be fantastic. That's the main, one of the main challenges is not just getting physically fit, but fit. How long does it take? You set out at about 1 a.m. because you want to get up and down before the sun comes out and starts melting the ice, which is holding rocks, and once it melts, those rocks start falling. So you start at 1 a.m., you get at 10,000 feet, you get to about 12,500 around sunrise, then the summit is, boy, I want to say like 8 a.m., 9 a.m., something like that, 8 a.m., and then you're trying to get down by 10 in the morning, or 11, something like that, because you just don't want to be, you know, having those things falling all around you. The risk is part of the allure for a lot of people. It's hard to explain, but that was the upshot and what they saw. Yes, she was talking about the ways in which the book covers both everything from the smallest little insect to the sort of grandeur of the mountain. Was asking if there are other places that sort of capture me in a similar way. And we share a small piece of land with friends up in the San Juans on Decatur Island. And that place has become, you know, very much a part of my life, my family's life, my kids. It's the only place that my kids have actually known their entire lives. We've moved other places, but Decatur has always been there. So that's become a part of it. You know, we moved to Bainbridge Island about 4 years ago, and one of the things that I did when we moved, shortly after we moved there, was I did a circumnavigation of the island along the shoreline. It's 53 miles around the shore, and I did it again in chunks, which you actually have to do because the tide will cut you off. You got to watch the tide tables and everything. But that was one of the ways that I thought would be interesting to try to start to get to know this new place that I was calling my home. And so that's, you know, I think the thing that all these things have in common is the way in which, for me, it's all about throwing yourself out there and just walking the land as a way of connecting it and starting to know it. And if you do that, you're going to run into all sorts of really interesting different micro pockets of different landscapes. You're going to learn about the tides and their effect on the island in different places. You're going to see things that you didn't expect to see, which for me was around Bainbridge. There are all these really interesting little ghost pipes coming out of the low bank, and sometimes they're just drainage pipes. But you wonder, it's like, God, what's, you know, the whole idea of, you know, non-source point pollution going into Puget Sound becomes very real when you start seeing all these pipes around. It's like, oh, okay, I see. This is one way in which fertilizer gets into the Sound, you know, that sort of thing. So a lot of it, like I say, is that just experience of walking the land and putting yourself upon it. This is a connection for me. Yeah. Yeah. They had a golf course at one point at Paradise, which is just crazy when you, if you've ever been up there and you know just that simply, like, it's the side of a mountain. Like, how are you going, you know, how are you going to get a golf course on a slope that's going like this? But they did it for a few years, you know, as a way to lure people up there. But that was, I think that was far and away the most surprising, most shocking. And it was kind of cool to see, actually, that the way in which it had been completely erased, like there was no way to figure out where it had been. That was just in you know, old histories of Rainiers. There's a good Park Service history of the mountain that is just like, it's massive, it's like that thick. It's, you know, it's got some incredibly boring title, and it's a great resource that I don't even know, most libraries don't have it. It was in the local Park Service office in the federal building down here, you know, that I found. But it's mentioned in a couple other books. Ruth Kirk wrote a couple great books about Rainier, and she, I think she mentions it in there. Yeah.
Is 16 years old?
Yeah.
Would you write the same book today?
Oh, no.
What would you do differently?
No. You know, part of the pleasure of and trick of this book was I could play the young, naive writer. You know, I was in my 20s, and I really didn't know a whole lot about the subject. You know, I don't think I can. You can pull that off once, you know. You know, I can't pull it off again. I mean, I'm working on a book now about the battle over salmon and treaties in the Northwest, and sort of book that, you know, culminates in the Bolt decision, everything before and everything after. And that's a book that I can't go in as a naive young man. I go in more as a mature writer in his 40s who grew up with this controversy as a kid and is really wanting to know the guts, the roots of the thing. You know, how far it goes back, what was at stake, what's still at stake today, how that one decision shaped, you know, the entire Northwest after it. In terms of how we manage our natural resources, so that's a book that you've got to go in with a much more knowing and mature attitude and voice, you know, because you're not the same person as the person who wrote that book.
Well, I have to tell you, as a 20-something, you did a beautiful job.
Right. Thank you.
With this book, and thank you.
Thank you. It's great. Thanks for coming out.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.